Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, you're listening to Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm joined tonight by Mark Forsyth. Mark Forsyth is a writer, journalist, blogger and pedant. Every job he's ever had, whether as a ghostwriter or a proofreader or a copywriter, has been to do with words. He started the Inky Fool blog in 2009 and now writes a post almost every day. The blog has received worldwide attention and enjoys an average of 4,000 hits per week. Mark is the author of The Etymologicon, a circular stroll through the hidden connections of the English language. Mark, let's talk about the Inky Fool blog, first of all. Why did you start to write that?
Partially because I'd been a frustrated writer for so very, very long, and I thought, or it suggested to me, actually, that a blog was the way forward. And the thing I think a blog needs, which is facts, is information that other people don't have. And I have a brain which is just a huge rubbish heap of strange stories about words. I've always been fascinated by words. And so I thought I can put a fact a day up there. Well, I mean, more than a fact a day, a little essay a day.
So, I mean, despite the fact that I've just said that you've always worked with words, let's talk about when you first became interested in why you're so interested in words.
It came on me slowly. I got a copy of the Oxford English Dictionary as a Christmas present and sort of never looked back. Not a Christmas present, a christening present, back when I was a little baby. But it's more, it's when you're studying languages at school and you realise that it's the same word in French and then a slightly different word in Latin, but then you see a Latin when you say how did that come to the English? For example, there's a farnum, a Latin word for a temple, and then you get from that, you get fanatic in English, and which is somebody who goes to a temple too much. And from that, and you just shorten that, and you get a fan. And so that's why you have a fan of a pop group or whatever it happens to be. And it's that sort of thing, once you suddenly realise it, and that terribly familiar word, the fan, and then, you know, the slightly more posher word, fanatic, and then on back onto the temple and all that sort of thing. And you start to see this huge labyrinth, the massive edifice behind the language that you use every day.
So the book, The Etymologicon, is a collection of stories about words and indeed the word itself was invented by Milton to describe a book containing etymologies of words. It has an interesting structure. Tell us about that, first of all.
Well, the structure sort of came out of me not being able to stop. I found when I was writing a blog post, I'd start off writing about one word and then get carried away and say, well, of course, that connects to this other word and that connects to this other word and so on and so forth. And I tend to have to sort of stop myself and go off and have a cold shower. The book, when I was offered the book deal, I thought, you know, the great way to do it would be just be to go on and on and on and see how far I could go on these connections that, you know, fan fanatic and farnum aren't in the book, but that the strange moment when you suddenly realise there is the next moment. So there's a reasonably well-known etymology, for example, that Bluetooth technology, which unites the warring provinces of mobile phones and computers. It's named after Harald Bluetooth, who was the king of Denmark in about 1000 AD, and he united the warring provinces of Denmark, and then that's why it's named after him. But then I discovered, quite by coincidence, that his daughter-in-law was Queen Gunhilda, and that Queen Gunhilda had a cannon named after her several centuries later in Windsor Castle, and it was called Queen Gunhilda, and then it got shortened. It was just started being called Gun for short, and that's why they're called guns. And so these two people, father-in-law, daughter-in-law, have modern inventions named after them that they would never have even been able to conceptualize. Well, I mean, we'd probably been able to imagine if you'd explained it to them. But this one little nuclear family.
And we could, basically, I'm having to keep restraining myself because we could just carry on from there.
Well, exactly, I do carry on, and that's the structure of the book. It just carries on and carries on and carries on.
Well, before we'll spend most of the show just basically going from one interesting word to another, but We've just talked about, I just said that Milton invented the word that you named the book after, and it does sound like a word that somebody's made up, and Milton invented the word loquacious, and you mentioned that Horace Walpole invented serendipity, which again sound like words that people have made up. But you also mentioned that Milton invented the words damp and cooking.
Yeah, and wording.
And Shelley invented the words moonlit and bloodstain, which are the two that stuck out to me. They're like much more familiar words. It seems incredible to think that cooking, I mean, surely somebody must have said cooking before Milton.
I think he invented it as a noun, as opposed to cookery, which would be the more usual and older English form, I think, as far as I can remember from my OED. The words pop up that you would imagine had always been around. I mean, I've got a chapter on De Quincey, who invented entourage and earth-shattering. But an earth-shattering seems obvious to us now, you know, this is an earth-shattering event. But actually, if you think about it, the earth has never shattered. And also, why put those two particular words? Mm-hmm. Why not call it world-breaking or anything else? But De Quincey had that great talent for seeing the right phrase and, you know, the phrase that your tongue likes to work around.
You mentioned this idea that when you're first getting into words, we start to discover that there are words that have sort of common roots and things that are sort of hidden, strange connections. And you talk about a very sort of early language called Proto-Indo-European. So let's talk a little bit about what that was.
The funny thing about Proto-Indo-European is no one actually knows what it was. The best way to think about it is if you learnt French and then you learnt Spanish and then you learnt Italian, you would be able to realise that they were related and that they must go back to some common language, some ancestor, which is, of course, we know because we've got the history, is Latin and it was spoken 2,000 years ago. Unfortunately, with Proto-Indo-European, we don't have the history, so all we can do is take a guess. But it would appear that almost every language in Europe and Persian and the North Indian languages all come from a single common ancestor, which was probably spoken about 4,000 BC. Probably by the Kurgan pit burial culture. I mean, at least what we can say for sure is there's a society where you can dig them up archaeologically, and they, as you can imagine, they buried people in pits and they made pottery in some, you know, particular pattern form and all those other archaeological things. And then they suddenly spread out and invaded every which way about 6,000 years ago, 4,000 BC. And so they look like the prime culprits for spreading these languages, which then spit off. And all you need to do is for changes in pronunciation to come about. For example, the ones that went to Northern Europe seem to have started pronouncing their P's as F's. And that's why you have pater in Latin and padre, and even if you go to Sanskrit in India, you have patier, which meant father, but in German you have vater, and that gives us the English father. So it and the same thing if you have fatherly fishes in English or German, you'd have paternal Pisces in Latin. You can deduce these patterns of changes and therefore deduce what the original language could be, or you can make a damn fine stab at deducing what the original language would be.
On a more general level, you talk about something called Grimm's Law, which is, I can't remember which one, but one of the brothers Grimm. Is it Jacob?
I can't remember myself.
One of the brothers
now.
Grimm.
Yeah.
So what is Grimm's Law?
Grimm's Law, we're straying back to the Proto-Indo-European European variations. It's the way that sounds changes is the P's and the F's and the like that sounds changes. They come into Germanic languages, which separates us out. And it's lovely when you get those changes. But you have a similar ones with, say, sass in Sanskrit, which is Indian, is six, and then it's sex in German, and it's sextus in Latin, and it's hex in Greek, and that's why it's a hexagon. And you might think that was a coincidence, but then you see the same thing happening with sept, 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 seven, etc., and hept. And so you that's how you realise that there's this pattern of change. Numbers are great for this, because numbers never change through the years.
You mentioned, and you don't actually really talk about this in the book, so I might be putting you on the spot a little bit here, but you mentioned that nearly all European languages are derived from this root. There are, strangely, some languages that aren't they?
Yeah, there's Hungarian is a Uralic language, I think.
So how do these sort of things happen? Do we know what the sort of root of those sort of languages would be and how they became to be sort of like islands cut off, surrounded by Proto-Indo-European speakers?
In a word, no. I mean, one of the great mysteries is Basque, which is the language spoken by the Basque people in the sort of Pyrenees and northern Spain, which is a language isolate. It's one of the very rare ones where absolutely no one knows any connection. But the thing is, all that means is that we can trace Proto-Indo-European so far back, or our languages, is that Sanskrit and ancient Greek and Latin started to be written down from a sort of 2000 through to 1000 BC. And the same thing goes for Hittite, which is a dead part of the family tree, which is terribly early. So we're able to trace it back because we can see those connections. It might be that if we had Basque writing from 3,000 years ago, we'd be able to say, it's related to Japanese or whatever. There are people who theorise strange things like this. But unless you can demonstrate that pattern of connections, that look at all these words which begin with a P in most of the languages and begin with an F in the Germanic languages, then you can't be certain. And it's just, the same thing goes for the language of the Native Americans in America, who just didn't have the writing. Generally speaking, there were some sort of primitive forms of writing around, but generally speaking, you don't have the records. So maybe if we had 3,000 years of writing from them, we will be able to discover the proto-North American language, but we don't, so we can't.
Okay, so as I mentioned before, we'll spend the rest of the show, basically the rest of the show is going to consist of me prompting you to shouting out words, and that's you to talk about them pretty much, but you start and end this book with the word book, so we should talk about that first of all.
Well, yeah, it's just one of the lovely things which excites me, possibly because I'm so pathetic, to discover that book is named after the old German buch, which meant beech tree, because beech trees have very soft wood, so you could carve things in them. And so their word for the thing you write on was buch, and then that became bok in Old English, and so on to us. But it all goes back. They haven't changed the word since trees. And obviously the material has changed to parchment and then to paper, and now if you've got a Kindle to, a touchscreen. But actually, Kindles aren't touchscreen, are they? But but that wonderful way that the history of writing is inscribed in the very familiar words we use every day.
There's another example of this further in the book, and let's talk a little bit about the connection between sheep and books.
Well, sheep and books is it's what you used to, before paper, which was paper was manufactured from papyrus, and therefore papyrus only, well, the main papyrus source is northern Egypt. So in medieval times in northern Europe, books were made out of parchment, which was made by killing a sheep. You killed a sheep, you skinned it, you cut out the biggest rectangle you could, you hung it up on to dry on a thing called a tenter, using tenter hooks, which is where the phrase on tenter hooks comes from. Then you folded it up several times in order to make either a... a folio if you fold it once, or a quarto, or an octavo, etc., etc. Which means that even when the first printing presses were invented with paper, they were still gauged to the size of the biggest rectangle you can cut out of an adult sheep. And then printing presses, were just mass-produced, manufactured. They didn't change size, which means that your standard paperback, your standard hardback, your standard atlas are still based on the size of an unfortunate skinned sheep. And even now, even though this is the beauty of it, even when they introduced the Kindle and these other e-reading things, that they kept the size because they said people like books to be about this size. And so the size of the Kindle is basically based on a sheep.
All right, let's can we perhaps talk a little bit about the connection of gonads and testicles to the Old Testament, please?
This is a rather strange one. Testicles and testament are related, and so is testify and any witness testimony. And no one's quite sure why. There are a bunch of theories. One is that it's that your testicles are a witness to your manhood and therefore testify to it. And there's another idea that it's all of them come from a root meaning three, because if two people are in a dispute, a third party is the witness. And then yet another one comes from the idea that It seems, archaeologically, there's good scholarship to suggest, at least, that people used to... If I were to swear an oath to you, an oath of loyalty to you, Neil, then I would have to... and if we were in ancient Israel or the ancient Near East, then I would do so with my hand on your balls. Which is my favourite theory for obvious reasons. nobody's quite sure. There's even a bit in the book of Genesis, I think it's Genesis, where it says, put your hands upon my soft parts and swear. It's usually translated in the King James Version's thigh. But
That's still quite intimate.
Yeah, thigh is still quite intimate, but the Hebrew just says soft parts.
It's actually interesting that it's now become that you put your hand on a Bible to swear if you're, in a court.
Well, I mean, you know, the Testament and the testicles, it's the same thing.
Before we go into the second half, I'll just keep the tone
I think
level.
We should raise the tone.
We'll talk about cod pieces, basically, and how they're related to something on a computer keyboard.
That's a very strange and long story, if we can do it before the halfway break. Yeah. It's the old Gaulish word for trousers was bracca, and then the little trousers, i.e. your codpiece, became a braguette. That was the old French term. And then, it's hard to do this without diagrams, really, but then somebody was looking at the architectural structure, the thing which comes out of the wall and holds up a ceiling or a balcony or whatever, and they said, you know what that looks like? That looks like a codpiece. And so it became known as a braguette, as an architectural feature. And this is what I love about the strange stories of words. Once you start researching them and researching them and researching them, the guy who seduced, or possibly didn't seduce, Pocahontas, Captain John Smith. She was actually only 10 at the time, so I hope he didn't seduce, I don't know. But Captain John Smith, once he'd finished with Pocahontas and came back to England, wrote a naval dictionary, because that's the kind of thing real men did back then. And so he wrote a naval dictionary, and he was talking about braguettes in ships, but he spelt them brackets. And so that's where our modern spelling with the CK comes from. And then people started using double brackets to hold up shells, which is, look at the nearest set of shells to you, you'll see the right angle. If you have two of those right angles, that's a double bracket. And then look at your computer keyboard, top right, and you'll see the square brackets, which look just like those shells. And that's done by association. And so those two keys, the little pictures on them, derived from old French cod pieces.
But you're listening to Little Atoms tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Mark Forsyth about his book, The Etymologicon. Folk etymology you talk about in the book. Well, there's a couple of really interesting stories in that. Tell us what folk etymology is, first of all.
Folk etymology is, roughly speaking, when people get a word wrong. They look at a word and they say, that can't be right. So, for example, ling is a diminutive suffix in English. What that means is that a duckling is a little duck, and a gosling is a little goose, and a darling is a little deer. And a little guy who stood at the side of a lord and sort of ran around after him as part of his entourage used to be called a sideling. And sideling became a common word. But then everyone forgot why they'd been called sidelings in the first place. And it was somebody got the idea into their head that it must be because there must be a verb. It must be because they sidled. And so that's where the English word sidle comes from, as in sidle up to someone. It's a mistake based on a little boy, a little earthling, a little sideling standing at the side. And you get the same thing with umble pie, which was pie made from umbles. The umbles are the offal of a deer. They're the innards of a deer. And somebody said, that can't be right. They've just missed the H off humble. And so it became humble pie, and you started eating humble pie. And I actually found a recipe for that. I was really proud of this. I found a 1726 or whatever it was recipe somewhere deep in the bowels of the British Library, and I put it in the book and actually cooked some for myself. It's delicious. It's really good. I was thoroughly surprised.
But offal is very popular these days. I'm surprised it's not back on menus. Give us the example of the dormouse, which is the one that was particularly taken
by. Well, the dormouse appears to be a similar mistake. There was a little sleepy rodent, which the French called dormeuse because it was asleep so much. And when that got over to England, somebody said, dormeuse, it makes no sense. It's just a misspelling of dormouse. Despite the fact that then rodents, they're not mice at all. And also they have nothing to do with doors. But it's just another classic case of somebody saying, I know better than the dictionary, so I shall change it.
I want to jump ahead a little bit and sort of link to, in some way, to how you just described how we come by the word "cidal," which is like a mistake. A little later on, you talk about something called fossil words, which is in some way look like they might have been mistakes, but aren't necessarily. And by fossil words, you give examples of words which anybody, not for the same meaning, but anyone who's familiar with Father Ted will have heard the word feck, and you give the example of the word gorm as well. So what do we mean by this? What are fossil words?
Gorm was an old English word meaning brain or sense or nous, and it used to be a common word all over England, and then it became just, it's like kind of dwindled and became just a dialect word in Yorkshire, and everyone would have forgotten about it except in Wuthering Heights. It mentions somebody calling somebody else gormless, and the word seems to have acquired, well, gormless appears to have acquired popularity just from that novel, despite the fact nobody knew what gorm meant anymore. And you have the same thing repeated again and again and again. I mean, feckless, for example, is not to do, I don't think, with the Father Ted feck. It's that the English word effect got shortened to feck in a Scottish dialect. And then if somebody had no effect on the world, they were deemed to be feckless. And then that came back into English whilst the original word died. And sometimes you have fossil words just which hang around in phrases like kith and kin, for example, where, I mean, everyone knows the phrase, but could you define kith for me? Kith is, in fact, the opposite of uncouth. Kith means your acquaintances. Uncouth means things you don't know about. And so kith just survives in that one little phrase and nowhere else.
It's just reminded me, actually, there's another example of a sort of mistake that's got into a common phrase. And this is the idea of the being on the straight and narrow.
Yeah, straight, well, it's everyone spells it G-H-T. It's not. It's S-T-R-A-I-T, as in a straight jacket or the Straits of Gibraltar. It's something constricted which holds you in, so it's the straight and narrow gate originally, the straight and narrow way, the constricted, disciplined, don't stray away from it.
But not a straight as in a straight line.
Not straight as in a straight line. No, straight as in straight jacket. It's the straight and narrow.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about... We should talk about science a little tiny bit, because, you know, it is that sort of show.
Yeah.
So you talk about words that are derived... And people are going to kill me now for saying we should talk about science, but let's talk about words that are derived from astrology.
Well, you've got to remember, astrology and astronomy used to be separate subjects, but they're all sorts of strange ones, like a disaster, which is a dis-astra. It's when you're ill-starred, the stars are in the wrong position, and so you get your catastrophe or disaster. You have the same thing about being under the influence. The influence was originally the influence of the stars, which Jupiter or Jove would make you jovial, and Mars would make you martial, and so on and so forth. And Saturn would make you saturnine and dark.
So another thing that we definitely have to get into for a show of this type is the derivation of the words bunkum and debunking.
That's a beautifully strange one. Debunk, because it's a classic sort of one where you think you debunked a theory, or you kicked it out of its bunk bed, and then you find out, no, it's debunkumed it, as in bunkum be, or utter nonsense. And then you keep chasing, and you find that there was once a senator who gave a very stupid speech in the US Senate, or could have been the House of Representatives, I can't quite remember on this, and it was incredibly stupid, and people started telling him to stop and really shut up, and, you know, the so hand clap and all of this. And he went on and on and on and on and on. And afterwards, people said, why did you keep going on? And he said, well, I was giving the speech for you. I was giving it for the journalists so it would be reported back to my constituents in Buncombe County, North Carolina. And so, therefore, and from that, it became a byword in the US Senate that if you were speaking for Buncombe, you were talking absolute nonsense. That's where we get the word Buncombe from. And Buncombe comes from this lovely, so far as I can tell, beautiful rural bit of North Carolina. And then because I can never quite stop, I had to go on. I had to find out that there was a guy, I think it was called Edward Buncombe, who was a hero of the American War of Independence and died by falling downstairs. And then I wanted to know where the family name Buncombe came from, and I found it comes from Buncombe, meaning Valley of the Reeds. And then I think to myself, and this is what makes me such a boring person, because then I think to myself, Coombe, that's one of the very few Gaelic words that got into Old English, and it keeps leading me off down lines that I would never have expected.
The Anglo-Saxon Celtic thing is something that I did want to talk about, but we're pretty much out of time, and it's quite complex, so I'm going to just talk about one other really interesting story, and you might have noticed that I've opened the book on the right page for this one, but I'll be incredibly impressed if you don't need me to do it. But I want to talk about the derivation of the Nazi Party.
Oh, I don't need the book for that, luckily.
I'm very impressed.
I did just pick it up. the strange thing is the Nazis didn't call themselves Nazis. The problem is that Hitler really, really screwed up on the naming. The butt of jokes in the standard joke about stupid people in Germany in the 2030s would be about Bavarian peasants, and there would just be this Bavarian peasant character who'd walk into every joke, and his name was Nazi or Ignatius. Short for Ignatius, Nazi. And so when Hitler started up the Deutsche Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, people, it was just an open target. It was like if Sarah Palin started up Red States for the Next America, they'd be called the Rednecks. But because history is written by the people who fled the Nazis, we think of that as their official name, which it never was. It was an insult.
We're out of time. Mark, thank you very much for joining us on Little Atoms today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.